Welcome to the Gentleman Ultra Podcast. I'm your host, Frank Risotto. And today I'm joined by the co-founder of the First Time Finish website and author of the new book, due out on the 18th of July via Pitch Publishing. It's called The Working Hand of a Goddess, Tom Underhill. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yep. So The Working Hand of a Goddess, for those that don't know, do you want to explain what that is and why you decided to write this book?
Yeah, so yeah, The Working Hands of a Goddess is the story of Atalanta's rise and kind of unprecedented kind of adventure under Giampiero Gasperini since he took over in June 2016. Completely unforeseen kind of explosion towards the top of the league table and playing some of the most fantastic, entertaining, enthralling football on the continent. And it's a story that hadn't really, it's been kind of documented quite well via kind of tactical articles, but not so much in a book form. And there's very little on Atalanta written in English, particularly in book form. So I felt there was a story to be told there in a slightly different way. And yeah, I first really became aware of them about, I think it was Gasperini's second year when they're in the Europa League, and they beat Everton 3-1 in the Europa League, and it was just a jaw-dropping kind of awakening. I was like, oh my, this is incredible. Like I only switched it on because Everton were in the Europa League and they'd signed some pretty interesting players. They had Ronald Koeman as their manager, and they'd signed Wayne Rooney, Sandro Ramirez, Gylfi Sigurdsson, kind of quite an interesting team to kind of follow in Europe. And they got just absolutely blown away by Atalanta at Sassuolo Stadium. And ever since then, I've just been I'd like to call myself a fan now, if I may. So felt it was a story that I really wanted to tell, and it's been a privilege to tell it as well, I'd say.
So had you seen Atalanta prior to that, or did you go into that game with the stereotypical boring Italian team that's going to sit back and...
Well, I remember I was at university at the time, and I remember switching on the TV and seeing that there was Europa League on, and I was like, oh Everton, oh this would be interesting to watch. And so I didn't really take note of who it was against. Atalanta, I was like, oh, I think they're the Italian team, but honestly had no preconceptions whatsoever. I had no idea what was the fact they finished fourth the season before and would have been in the Champions League were it not for Serie A's kind of allocation of European place at the time, only allowing the top three in. Like that was a Champions League worthy team, and they were playing the Europa League. I had no idea about any of that. And then I kind of watched, and then I saw Papu Gomez ping one into the top corner from the kind of left half space. And my first thought was, who the hell is this guy? He is amazing. He is absolutely incredible. And then I kind of just started to watch the rest of what happened around the team. Brian Cristante, I think Andrea Petagna played that one. He was quite an interesting kind of big burly, well, young but kind of big and burly forward at the time. Froiler, like there was just so much going on that I was just loved. Yeah. And then the return fixture was when they beat them 5-1 at Goodison Park, which is, I think it turned out to be Goodison Park's lowest ever attendance. I think it was literally an empty Goodison Park. Clearly people just not fancying going to see their struggling side play an Italian team they'd never heard of before. And Atalanta pulverized them 5-1 or 5-0. And I remember on the commentary, Chris Sutton saying that they were Atalanta's biggest threat was from set pieces. And I just remember thinking, like, are you watching this? Are you seeing what's happening? There's so much more than that. There's so much more interesting stuff going on here than just set pieces. And that's where it kind of started, I suppose.
Was anyone else watching that game with you? Was there, you know, a moment when you're like, you must watch this. Look at what we're witnessing here.
I wish there was. I remember I was literally on my own in my flat at uni, and being like, oh, this is so cool. This is just, this team is great. And then I kind of like half followed them. And then as I kind of finished my time at uni, I'd started writing properly and I was really starting to like watch as much football as I could, like kind of watch kind of 5-6 European games in a weekend. But I'd make sure that one of those every single weekend was Atalanta. It like, it didn't really matter who they were playing. And and then ever since then I've kind of been trying to preach to people and kind of tell them about like, oh, forget about, you know, not forget about, but you know, like there's this great team in Italy you have to watch. And luckily some people have kind of watched a decent amount of games with me so that they're kind of on board with it too. So yeah, I'd definitely say I'm preaching there. Preaching how great they are.
yeah, that's great. That's great. Yeah. So is that what attracted you to writing the book? Essentially, that's why you wrote the book. Did you want to spread the word?
To an extent, yeah. Like, because I think there's just so much, there's so many layers to what has gone on there in the past 5 years. Like I've always wanted to write a football book ever since I was 7-8 years old. I've always wanted to be a football writer, but to actually make the point of I had to first find the idea before I kind of put forward that I wanted to do it, because it had to be something that interested me on not just a footballing level. And what's happened with Atalanta in terms of not just the results, not just their incredible points tallies, but the style and the excitement that goes with it. Then you've got the ultra culture, the Atalanta ultras being so integral to everything that that club has been through 3 divisions in the past 40 years, and their fan community has been intrinsic to their rise and fall. It's fascinating.
Yeah, because they were almost like a early 2000s, 20th century, they were almost like a yo-yo club. You know, it was always, you know, up 1 year, then back down again. Then, you know, I think 1 year they finished 7th and the next year they got relegated. Then they were back up again the following year. So, when I grew up watching Italian football, they were always one of those teams that you saw them 1 year and then they were gone the next and they were back again. It's not the Atalanta that we know today that has that structure in place, you know, and that front office in place that, you know, no one knows about, and no one knows who does what, but aside from a few names you hear every now and again.
Absolutely. I mean, like, there have been a few kind of long-term, like, managerial stints at Atalanta you've had. So the Gasperini one being most recent, who I think is in sight of the most, of the record for most match, Serie A matches as Atalanta manager, or league matches, one of the two. You had Stefano Colantuono, who came in 2 different spells, but was there for kind of 2-3 years at a time. And then you had Emiliano Mondonico, which was the 90s, which was like the team of Kinesia and Stromberg. But outside of that, they've been perennial up and down. And during the 1970s, they didn't stay in the same division for more than 1 year at a time for a whole decade. Yeah. Just up, it was going to Serie A, Serie B, Serie A, Serie B, Serie C1, and then like just... It was incredible.
Yeah.
And all of these things that we kind of assume about them today has literally come quite ironically with a manager who is one of the most prone to being thrown out of clubs, and yet he's absolutely found a home and matched up to everything that the club and also the city, like everything that Gasperini, he divides a lot of people, but he gets what it means to be Bergamaschi and how important that team is to the city. And yeah, it was a very unusual marriage that just like atoms colliding, it just somehow worked and made something quite incredible.
Yeah, because he didn't have the greatest of starts either. From memory, I don't remember. Yeah, if I'm thinking straight, I'm thinking about the right person. I'm not thinking about his Inter stint, but I'm thinking about his Atalanta stint. I'm sure he started off slowly there too.
It was disastrous. He won one of his first 5 matches, and it didn't look like a Gasperini team at any point. He tried with a back 3, I remember the first game was against Lazio and they lost 4-3 in Bergamo, which doesn't sound the worst. Like, you know, Atalanta at the time were a lower mid-table team. It's not the worst thing to put up a seven-goal thriller of Lazio, but they were absolutely torn apart, and the back three was really unusual. They hadn't learnt the unique demands that Gasperini asks of his centre-backs. I think there were four different full-backs playing that day, and Christian Raimondi started, who was club captain, beloved by the club, and from that game it was very clear that he was not going to work, and that was quite a difficult thing to kind of see. And yeah, they won one game in the first five, and Gasperini was summoned to President Picassi's office, and it looked very much like, here we go, this is the Inter debacle again, he's going to be let go. But Picassi is a very different breed of president, and he said, look, I've hired you, you're my guy, I have full faith in you, you don't try and live up to what you think I want, you do what you want to do. And Gasperini said two things. He said, I want to play three at the back, and I want to utilize the youth system that we have here, which he'd never had that any of his other clubs. He'd never had either had the time or the resource to really tap into academy talent. And
such
now
a,
he had it.
Such a rich catchment area, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely incredible. Like he brought through some very young, promising players, but he'd never had the mine of cultivated, you know, technical players. That first season, just to reel some off, you had Mattia Caldara, who obviously has had a bit of a decline since, but at the time was an outstanding young centre back to come through. Franck Kessier, who was the only shining light in those opening five games. He scored twice in the opening game against Lazio. You had Roberto Gagliardini, again, not a particularly fashionable player now, but at the time was perfect for what Gasperini wanted as a centre midfielder. Andrea Petagna, Andrea Conti, Leonardo Spinazzola, like there's so many of them. And he brought them all through in that first season. Mm. And yeah, I think that was clearly a manager who was like, wow, I've never had this before. I'm going to use this to its maximum.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think it is that makes him so decisive? Gasperini, he's such a I don't know what the word is, but he
love or hate.
Milan fans don't like him. Napoli fans despise him. You know, he doesn't go down well at Inter. What is it about his personality or his character that just rubs people the wrong way?
I think you've kind of mentioned the word there. It's personality. I think there are a lot of fans around Italy that have enjoyed Atalanta's success. They've broken a bit of a monopoly of the kind of top six, top seven that nobody expected, and seeing them go far in Europe. A lot of people have wanted to enjoy it, but the reason that many haven't is because they hate Gasperini so much, and it's because he's a very divisive personality. He falls out with players very quickly. I remember Robin Gosens said that when he went to Atalanta, he kind of came in as like a second choice left back behind Spinazzola. So you think there might not be too much pressure on him, you know, just adapt, let him adapt and come in. But Spinazzola was severely injured that season, so Gosens was thrown in, and his relationship with Gasperini was not very good at the start. And I think I remember words to the effect of Gasperini told him that he wasn't of the required standard to be an Atalanta player. And many players, either they sink or swim under him. They either say, I can't do this, I'm going to... And in a way, he respects that. I think it was Martin Skrtel, start of 2019-20 season. Atalanta brought in Martin Skrtel, and a bit of experience, not exactly the profile you'd imagine would be an Atalanta centre-back. But after 3 weeks, Skrtel went to Gasperini and said, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to cancel my contract. This isn't working for me. Your training demands are too extreme.
He did an Antonio Cassano and just said, no.
exactly that. And Gasperini said, you know what, I respect that. That's fine with that. So you have the sinkers or you have the swimmers. And Gosens is the type of character that is an absolute, like he'll just work and work to prove what he's able to do. And he turned out to be, I mean, if you're making a greatest ever Atalanta 11, I don't think Gosens would be too far away from the left back slot, which kind of shows that, you know, the kind of the how he overturned that start. So you got that side to it. And then if he's not winning, he's a frustrating character. Like when Atalanta went on their they went on their first ever three-match winless streak under him, which is that in itself is incredible. It took into his sixth year to reach that. But the month before that, when it was, you know, draws against Genoa, I can't remember who else was getting, he was refusing to speak to the media after matches. Like, it was just, he's not a good loser. And then if you're an opposition fan, he's not a good winner. Like the 5-1 beating of Milan in early 2020, when he started dancing on the sidelines, Milan fans have never forgiven him for that, let alone the fact he was an Inter manager as well. So people will take a lot of pleasure in his failures. I think that's just, he knows that as well. It's the character he's built. It's no surprise to him.
He's an intense, he comes across as an intense man, isn't he?
Definitely.
So how much success, like we hear about Gasperini and we hear the name Percassi and, you know, we hear of the sporting director and a few other names, but we don't hear a lot of what goes on inside the front offices of Atalanta and how they've managed to keep this train heading in the same direction and there's no derailment coming from, you know, any side. What does Antonio Percassi bring to the club? What has he done for this team? Has it been undervalued what he's brought to this club and to the city of Bergamo?
When kind of answering this question, there are a few things to kind of look at. So first of all, the heights that they've reached are entirely on Gasperini. Reaching third place for two of the last five seasons, for 2019-20 with two games left of the season, it was unlikely. But if Juve had lost their last two games of the season, Inter had lost, and Atalanta had won their last two games of the season, Atalanta would have been Serie A winners in 2019-20. That is on Gasperini. That is his ability to take unfancied, below-the-radar players and produce incredible attacking output of them. That is on Gasperini. But the bits that go before it that have perhaps enabled him to do that are the stuff of Percassi. So, like, take for example, when Gasperini came in, he decided that he wanted to use the young, you know, the kids in that opening season. In the years since, the average age has gone up quite a lot. He's liked quite an experienced 11. But in that first season, he didn't have a lot of choice other than to use the likes of Conti, Caldara, Gagliardini, 21, 20-year-olds. The reason that those players were able to come in and do so well was that in the decade before, Percassi had decided that they wanted to adjust the Atalanta model. The Atalanta model had always been bring through local Bergamaschi talents straight through the academy, throw them into the first team, age 17, and if they're not immediate hits, it's fine because we're a team that goes up and down. They'll get their playing time. If they're a star, then a team will come and buy them from us, or we'll have them and we'll get better. If they don't, it's fine. This is our model. Percassi changed that, where he looked at the academy and thought, well, when these players are of age of 17, 18, we're going to send them out on loan to Serie B, to lower Serie A. So it means that when they then come in, they're going to be of a higher standard than they would have been if we just thrown them straight in. So all three of Caldara, Conti and Kessier had all been out on loan for the season before Gasperini came in, and they all played substantial league minutes. So they'd had a proper cutting of teeth year. And it meant that when Gasperini said, well, I want to use them, well, they were ready to go. Obviously, the extent to which how good they were couldn't have been foreseen. But had they not had that season on loan, they probably wouldn't have been ready, particularly when you've got a manager like Gasperini who just murders players in training and asks bizarre things. Like, imagine if you're a young centre-back, age 17, 18, Gasperini throws you in as a central centre-back and says, yeah, whenever the ball's in the air, I want you to run out of your defensive line and try and head it, no matter where it is in the defensive third. You'd be thinking, like, what the hell is... I haven't been cut out for this. Whereas those players who've been out on loan might have that extra year of kind of adjusting and seeing different coaching techniques.
Being flexible and adaptable to...
Exactly.
Different coaches and exposed to different teams and different setups. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I look at Matteo Pessina when he finally got his chance when Papu Gomez left in 2020-21. He'd spent the previous season at Hellas Verona, which is where Ivan Juric was manager, obviously the major Gasperini disciple. Mm-hmm. So he'd had that adjustment period that he understood that he might, you know, if he was ever going to learn how to play that bizarre kind of 10 floating 10 role, it was going to be in a Gasperini's kind of light system. Yeah. And that sort of stuff is all on the work of Pacasti and Marino and the people who go on above Gasperini. So it's a perfect symbiosis between a manager who has done incredible, extraordinary things and a system that just works and predicates for him to do what he has to do. And you've also got things like, you know, when they bought their stadium in 2017, they were one of only four Serie A clubs to own their own stadium, which made them more profitable. Things like that just helps a mid-table club to begin to look upwards rather than looking down. In my opinion, a brilliant manager like Gasperini, and then it's only going to yield positive results.
Mm-hmm. And they've had their hits, like in the transfer market, whether it be bring someone in, send them out on loan, they don't see any first team action, mm-hmm. and sell them before they even hit the first team. You know, there's Musa Barrow and Kulusevski, which we all know about. You know, Bastoni went for 30 plus million or whatever it was. Everyone just associates him with Inter. Hopefully Scalvini won't go next, but there's you know, many examples of them doing that.
Exactly. I mean, the Bastoni one is absolutely fascinating because in the season he broke through, he made four Serie A appearances in the 2016-17 season. And that was a season when Atalanta's centre-backs were Rafael Toloi, Mattia Caldara, Andrea Masiello and Ervin Zukanovic, and that was it. And wow. You know, for a back three, you ideally want to have at least five fit and ready to go centre backs. Mm-hmm. And despite that, Bastoni still only made about four appearances. Like,
and there seems to always be the rough, hard, you know, tumble type, and then there's like the cultured type, and you know, like they're always paired off with each other as well.
Exactly. And despite that, Bastoni still couldn't find a way in, which you think that might be a bit of a red flag. You'd think if this kid is that good, then surely he could displace one of these, you know, at least get more than a handful of appearances. But then he went to but it was his performances in the Primavera where he was just, I mean, imagine seeing a young Bastoni playing for a Primavera team. It's how they must feel seeing Scalvini play. Like, it's just otherworldly. So Inter went and slapped a huge fee on him, and he, you know, barely even he didn't contribute to any of Atalanta's success this season, and yet his sale went towards huge squad improvements. And Kulusevski one's another one, like, made a few appearances, but it was on loan at Parma that he really kind of showed what he was about. And Amad Diallo, like, the list goes on. It's incredible. It shows that if you're a young kid and you're thinking of choosing, or the Atalanta Academy is kind of interested in taking you on, it's a win-win because you either break into the first team, a team that's going to be, even after Gasperini, will be a team that's in the upper half of the table, can even look higher than that, or you don't ever play for Atalanta senior team, but the eyes of Europe are on you and your development as a kid. You can get signed by Juventus, by Man United, age 17, without ever having barely played a Serie A match. It's incredible. It's just
amazing, isn't it?
It's just
this cash cow that just keeps producing for them.
It's complete and sustainable as well. Like, it's absolutely sustainable to keep, because there's now such a prestige around. In the same way that there's the prestige around the Red Bull group and their ability. There once was a claim that if someone, let's say Patson Daka, who's at Leicester now, came for RB Salzburg, there would have once been a kind of train of thought that would be, well, let's see him go to Leipzig first, and then we'll take that, by which point his price would have gone up. Whereas now, because the kind of the trust that's put in that footballing group and network, the biggest teams can now go straight to Salzburg and say, well, I'm going to go to source. It's exactly the same with the Atalanta Academy.
Yeah. It's like there's Sao Paulo, there's, you know, Paris, and soon there'll be Bergamo. Yeah.
Bergamo,
it was almost like a light version of Udinese many years ago. Same sort of system. Their scouting network was so established, and you know, the stories abound of, you know, hundreds of scouts on backfields across the world, signing the likes of, you know, Alexis Sanchez for little to nothing, and then cashing in on them. Yeah,
exactly.
So how important do you think the club's success was to sort of rebuilding post-pandemic? I know football is no replacement for loss of life, and it means nothing at the end of the day, but it's got a special connection with the city, being, you know, the only club in town. Do you think it helped sort of bring life back to the city and get a bit more atmosphere around the place and bring some sort of joy back into the minds, I guess, of the people from Bergamo?
Yeah, it was a strange one, because a lot of clubs will say that they're cursed, or that they have just unshakable bad luck. I mean, I think Atletico Madrid is a famous one, that they pride themselves on being the cursed club. They can never get the success that they kind of have deserved. When they have, it's been with like mitigating circumstances. Go back to Atalanta's only ever piece of silverware was the Coppa Italia in 1963. The day that they win it, or the day after, the Pope dies. The Pope happens to be Bergamaschi born. So Bergamo goes into mourning, people not wanting to leave their houses, crying on the streets on the day that Atalanta should be parading their trophy through the streets. And they've never won anything since. So there's an element of that in what happened, in that they were the what they called the biological bomb of the Atalanta v Valencia match at San Siro. That was meant to be the greatest night in Atalanta's history. They beat Valencia at San Siro in one of the most breathtaking displays of knockout football I think anyone has seen for a long time, from an Italian team anyway. And yet that was the night where the pandemic just obviously took hold. People took it back to Spain, took it back to Bergamo.
Yeah.
And it went crazy. And Atalanta were in their greatest ever moment. And not only did the pandemic happen, but it just spread so badly in Bergamo. And it just, you know, it was pretty much the European epicenter. The
capital there for a while, yeah, or the epicenter of everything that went wrong, yeah.
I remember Gasparini saying that he would be woken up, like he would hear the kind of the military trucks and stuff kind of going past and the emergency services when he was in bed at night. And that club was, you know, everything had been so positive and building around what they could do. The fact they were in the Champions League at all was just a miracle. And then this happened. And I know that when it looked at resuming, there was protest by the Atalanta ultras saying that the only reason we're restarting is for the football business. This club has always been about the old. Obviously, it's not the club's fault, but it's endemic of what football is. So this club has always been about giving back to the community, and the ultras and the fans have always been almost like they've been the icons of that club. So for them to not be there during, as they mounted a title charge, was very kind of savoury. And
they're known as one of the you know, the most reputable of ultras. You know, like everyone knows about them. So, you know, they carry a lot of sway, whether it be good or bad.
Exactly. Their ultra leader, or the Curva Nord 1907, which their biggest group was Boccia until the group disbanded. And people say that he was, you know, Roma has Totti, Juventus has Del Piero, Atalanta has Boccia. That was the level of fan kind of importance. And for them to be, Atalanta to be in their greatest ever season and to not have their fans for half of it was a very, it just took the edge off it. And they they hit 98 goals that season, which I think went back to Fiorentina in the 1950s, the most in the Serie A season. And they went on an insane unbeaten run. They lost once between the penultimate game of the season and the turn of the 2020 year, barring the PSG defeat. They were seconds away from knocking PSG out of the Champions League. And yet, even if they had gone through in the Champions League, there was still the sense of this doesn't really like rather than this healing or this feeling like it's escapism, there was a sense of this shouldn't really be happening at all because of the tragedy that's gone on and the fact that the fans aren't even there, then what is the point? It's just a bit sad, really. And
they didn't get to experience it, and they weren't a part of it.
Exactly. Yeah, didn't get to experience it, and they didn't even get to really experience it back home because of lockdowns and the kind of the even if things weren't in lockdown. I remember exactly whether things were in lockdown at the time of that PSG quarterfinal, but there was still the kind of the trepidation and the fear about being outside and being surrounded by people. And it's just a really unfortunate that season. Seeing Atalanta play in that kit and that season with those players, or that night at San Siro, the amount of times I've watched back that match for the purpose of writing this book, that amazing match with Hans Hatterbor scoring twice and Ilicic's best and Remo Freuler curling one into the top corner, that match will always forever be the day that the pandemic kind of took off. Such a shame, but...
Yeah. Well, going back to that, and back onto the field, that PSG game, I don't know if the ghosts still live long in the memory, but do you think that's like a big what if moment or what could have been moment for Atalanta? Do you reckon they got past that?
I mean, if you think about it, so PSG went on to play RB Leipzig in the semi-finals. RB Leipzig obviously a very strong team, but could Atalanta have beaten RB Leipzig? Very possibly. They wouldn't have gone.
Could have ended 5-4, 6-7.
Exactly. Yeah, it would have been an amazing match. Would they have won the Champions League? Probably. You know, they probably wouldn't have come up against Bayern in the final. Wouldn't have happened. But you wonder whether that match, winning that was the first European match, out of the lockdown and stuff. You wonder if they'd won that. In that match in Portugal, whether that might have kind of created a groundswell and just set the appreciation of what they were doing even higher. And the irony was they weren't even that great in that game. They were quite, I remember, I know Pasalic obviously opened the scoring and he had a pretty good game, but it wasn't vintage Atalanta at all. Like, it was a team that was very aware of who they were up against. And it took goals from Marquinhos and Eric Choupo-Moting to knock them out. Like, it's just, it wasn't exactly Mbappe and Neymar kind of.
It was like their momentum had sort of taken a bit of a hit prior to those games. And then, you know, if they'd played that game in the following week, then who knows what could have happened. But it was like they had sort of had to, it was like almost like a pre-season.
Exactly.
And they looked a bit clunky. And I always feel like it's like such a huge missed opportunity for them, you know, that whole season.
Definitely.
It makes it worse for what was happening off the field for them.
And like Atalanta's league form, they've gone on this insane unbeaten run. And then with two games left of the season, that was when their winning run stopped, just as they were kind of, I say, in, they could have in theory won the title if other results had gone their way, but they lost to Milan on the last day of the season. So they just hit like that little, that insane form they'd hit had just kind of ended. And yeah, I mean, in a one-off match, I stand by it, even to it, like they're having a bizarre season at the moment, really strange, like unable to win at home. But I stand by, if you put them in a one-off match against any team in Europe, I think Atalanta can beat anyone on their day. Like if they turn up.
That's the thing, isn't it? On their day, it's like the difference between their best and their worst performance a couple of years ago, it was quite a fine line. But it feels like this season, like their best and their worst is all over the shop. And whether it's they're trying new things, new tactics, new whatever it may be, bringing in new players, they just seem like a little bit clunky this year. It's not quite that smooth engine just, you know, just rolling over, and the players just knowing what they need to do, and the team looking like, oh yeah, we've done this before, we can get out of this situation.
Yeah, there's a few reasons for that. So the actual, I'm not sure the personnel is particularly any worse. I mean, they lost Christian Romero, who was outstanding last season, but they replaced him with Merry Demiral, who's also been very, very good. I think the problem has been injuries have just ravaged their season. Yeah, absolutely. Daroon spent time out. Zapata was on fire at the start of the season. Like they beat Juventus in Turin, and Zapata was putting one of the great centre forward performances. He was amazing. He was absolutely amazing. And then he got injured, and then he came back for a match against Cagliari at home, which Atalanta lost down to 10 men. He came off the bench, and then he had to be subbed off 10 minutes later because he'd been rushed back. And when you don't have Zapata playing the majority of your minutes, it means Luis Muriel has to pick up. And as great as Muriel is, he's not someone who plays by volume. He's not going to play 60, 70. You're not going to get the best of him with him playing 60, 70 minutes a match. You're going to get it in 35-minute bursts where he'll be just the most gifted player on the pitch, and he'll play off the last man. Yeah, exactly. And like spin off the back of a defender because Zapata's bullied them all game. If you're asking him to do it for 90 minutes with only, no, very limp, with like Mihaila coming off the bench, it's just not the same. It's a different. And yeah, that kind of thing is just it's just built up with players who usually play less minutes being asked to do more and having worse form for it. Pessina, Pasala has just been good in patches, but again, he's an impact player. Malinovsky has tried his best, but he's not had that same impact that he had last season. Gerzens' injury. Hatebor came back from injury, but it looks like just a different player now. He just hasn't got that pace. Those knee injuries have really crippled him. Just a bit of an unfortunate kind of collision of all these kind of, and then Ilicic is obviously unfortunate absence. Yeah, it's just,
it'll be interesting to see whether Gasperini brings through like that new generation.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely personnel there to do it. Like we've seen Scalvini play this season, he's just looked like a class act already.
He could start for the national team now, and I wouldn't be concerned at all.
Definitely,
I think there's a rash mistake here and there, but yeah, wouldn't be worried at all.
He definitely needs to fill out a little bit more. To be 6 foot, like 6 foot four at that age is pretty wild, but he definitely needs to, he's only about 160 pounds, so he does need to kind of fill out a bit. But there's even a lot of Atalanta fans think there's a future of him as central midfield. Like he's that cultured and safe on the ball. You then got Mustafa Cisse, obviously a fantastic story. He's only been in Italy like a matter of minutes, and then came on to score against Bologna after playing for a refugee team. You got Sidibe, who looks a really fun young 19-year-old. And then you've got not quite as young as, but my favourite player for that is Tone Kotmaners, who is just a sensational player. Like
he can play anywhere, really, can't he?
He was amazing. Yeah. He was amazing at RZ Alkmaar, like just playing left. He played at centre back. He played central midfield, and then this season he's even played as a like attacking midfielder, like running on beyond the striker, which I've never seen him do before. Like there's nothing, if you look at him, 6 foot. Barrel-chested, thumping shot from range. You'd never think he would have the skill set to be able to burst into the box. But he's done it this season. He's, excellent player. And they just shows that.
I was going to say, they just find those gems that they look around and they find that player that's, whether they're, you know, they're not being picked up on highlights or video clips or by fans or supporters, but just those unpolished gems that they can see something, or they obviously can see something that, you know, no one else can, whether it be data and analytical information. But yeah, he's one. I mean, he was linked with a few clubs prior to joining Atalanta, but when he joined, it was just almost like, oh, who's this guy? Where'd he come from?
Yeah, exactly. Like he's linked with Roma and Rennes in France, he was linked with. And then he'd also been, like, if you're looking at the profile of player and the things that he does well, loads of people said he, like, Man United need a central defensive midfielder. this is the go get this guy. Like, but he's just clubs like that are never going to be smart enough to look at Ozan Alkmaar. They're never going to be smart enough to do it. Whereas Atalanta can, and they do, and they're pretty fearless. And the transfer dragged on for many months. There was first interest registered in about July. And as someone who's, I've like followed his career for a few years, and I've done an interview with his youth coach, and I've loved him for a few years. I was like, oh, this is amazing. Like, this is one of my favorite players going to one of my favorite clubs. This is great. But it dragged on for a few months because Atalanta were trying to haggle the price down. And this is when Roma started looking at him as an alternative. They couldn't get Granit Xhaka. Mourinho wanted to get Kotmaners. I thought, you can't let him become a Mourinho player. Like, that's just not, that doesn't sit well with me.
He'll end up back in Holland in 12 months' time.
Exactly. But it's not even just the scouting. It's that you look at it's almost like the Gasperini curse in a way. It's like, they bring through these amazing, like, give such amazing performances out of these players. And then they get sold for big money and they just never quite hit the same. I mean, it's not they become bad players, but they just become different players and players that aren't allowed to shine in the same ways. So like Frank Kessier, for example, burst for as a 19-year-old, could do everything, like would shoot from range. Was very press resistant, which he does still show now, but he was allowed to dribble lots. He was winning the ball back. He was pressing. Frank Kessié is still a very good player, but I'm not sure I still see the same Kessié that I saw at Atalanta. Same with Brian Cristante. Same with Gianluca Mancini. It's really strange. He's just going back to his Genoa days. Iago Falca, who came through at Genoa, produced huge attacking output out of him, never showed it really again. Really strange that he manages to do this with these players. And I think it makes clubs quite hesitant to buy from Atalanta. And I think it's probably why someone bigger than Spurs didn't come in for Christian Romero last season, because they're like, we just want to see, another step in there first before we commit money. And obviously, looking at him this season, they were foolish not to, because he's just an outstanding player. But yeah, it's a really interesting kind of quirk of Gasperini's kind of tenure in Bergamo.
Yeah. So speaking of Bergamo again, you went there in March this year, is that right?
I did,
so is that your first match day experience in Italy?
It is. My first time ever in Italy, yeah.
Oh, wow, yeah. So how was attending a match at Atalanta in Bergamo, watching Atalanta at the Guai Stadium?
Oh, it was amazing. It was absolutely, absolutely amazing. I went there with my girlfriend, and like, she's not into football, but she said like being in that stand, so behind in the Curva Nord, so we're right at the top, just kind of let the ultras do their thing at the bottom, we'll just stand at the top and have a good view down below. But being in that kind of environment, it's a terrible game as well. It's 0-0 draw with Genoa. Like, literally could have predicted that was going to happen. Blessing Genoa, but the kind of the way the ground shakes and stuff with those fans is unlike anything I've ever heard. And I, you know, as somebody who writes about football, I get a chemical anytime I see any kind of football pitch. It does something to me. It's like I get like goosebumps. But walking out and seeing that stadium when I've been writing about it for the best part of a year, and you got this incredible contrast, seeing this new shiny silver kind of post box that's the new stand, and then you've got the 1920s architecture kind of going round the curva sud. It's just it was just an incredible experience, and Bergamo is just a stunning city. It's almost famous for not being a tourist kind of hotspot. If you're not going there to see Atalanta, you're not going there to then go to Milan, you quite easily not even be aware it's even a city.
It's like what's that called, like a blue collar town.
Exactly.
They call it Australia. I don't know what they call it, if that's terms applicable, but yeah, like a blue collar town, you know, it does. Yeah. Okay.
Famous for its kind of construction and kind of labor. And you just, without going there, you have no idea of like the architecture and the just how pretty it is and the foods. Like I could just wax lyrical about it. Like, I was only there for three nights and I've literally been trying to think of the next time I can go back. And like like living in England and how difficult it is and how to watch football over here, like to watch Premier League football over here, like how exclusive it is, how hard you have to try to find tickets that aren't going to break the bank. To be able to go over to Italy and to watch a Serie A match for €20 a ticket, it's just, it's how it should be. And it's very kind of, it's very validating that is like that's still going on outside of the country that I'm in, where it's like you have to pay so much to go and
outside of the English Super League. Is that right?
Premier League.
Yeah. What's the how did you go with tickets? Like, you know, it's everyone always talks about it's so difficult to get tickets, it's impossible to get tickets. I logged on from Australia when I last went, bought tickets for six different match days across two different websites, like the club's official ticketing websites, and I was blown out how easy the whole process was. It's just like, you know, take your ticket, print it out, and take your passport, and in you go.
Exactly. Yeah, I found this. I asked around a few people and said, like, what is it? What is the process like? And I looked on Atalanta's own site and I saw it was all in Italian. And I thought, oh god, this is going to be a bit difficult. It took until about a week before buying them, I realized there was a UK flag in the top corner, so I actually had the option of choosing the UK option. It can be easier. Like I saw when the tickets were going on general sale, and I thought, well, I'm going to get in there for the minute it does, just because you never know if they're going to sell out. And I had the choice of any seat I wanted in the whole ground, pretty much. It was just and on the day of the match, like the Serie A capacities were capped at 75% at the time, but you wouldn't even like know it. Like, it was the sound of the ground, and you didn't feel like you're in a reduced capacity stadium. And yeah, the actual process of getting in and buying tickets was just, it's good to be able to have a beer at your seat as well, which you can't get in the grounds anymore. That's always a nice
coffee.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Did you see any other games while you're there, or was it just to head across to Bergamo?
Just we weren't there long enough. We were there from a Friday morning to a Monday morning. So just the three nights. So the match was on the Sunday evening. We took a trip to San Siro got on the train to Milan and had a little look at San Siro. But not for a match, but you know, the amount of different Serie A and Serie B grounds that I would like to go to is just like as long as your arm, basically.
Especially around that area, like, you know, once you arrive into Milan, from Lega Pro all the way up to Serie A, there's so many grounds, you know, even within an hour and a half radius.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So would you, with the book that's due out, so it's 18th of July, that's correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yep. And the process behind that, like, where did you start in terms of this whole story? How did you come about, you know, essentially starting the book? But yeah, what was the process behind it all?
So the emphasis, I always wanted the emphasis to be on the tactical on pitch side of it, because that is the part that I could see most, like watching Atalanta matches and following them. The thing that was most like sung to me was the stuff that I could see on the pitch. So that was like always going to be the key part of it. So within the book, I've tried to break down, do a season by season kind of review of the 5 years going from 2016 to 2021 and the kind of tactical changes that happened from match to match within it. And then beyond that, like a chapter for each of the kind of the roles within the Gasperi system. So like you've got centre backs, wing backs, central midfielders, forwards, because like each of those different roles are asked to do such strange things that they wouldn't in many other teams. And it's like there's a lot of credit that deserves to go to each one of those in order to enable how brilliant their attack is. Like it's not just having brilliant attackers on the pitch. It's not just having Ilicic, Zapata and Gomez. It's having wide centre backs who are happy to kind of cover the wing backs going forward, or a central centre back who is almost kamikaze in his kind of will rush out and with blood pumping and try and win the ball on the halfway line, knowing that there's two wider centre backs who can cover him behind him, like, and then being able to find the profile of player to fit that, Christian Romero's, Demiral's, Caldara's, central midfield, like having, you know, they could have had much more flamboyant central midfielders than Frula and Daron.
Yeah.
But it takes those two, like, so they're often described as water carriers, which is kind of a bit of a slightly derogatory term for saying someone who's less talented, who just gives the ball to, you know, they said about, that's what Didier Deschamps.
Run, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
I always saw Freula, Hatterbor and Daron as just like everyday people. They're like the people I'd expect to see just walking past me on the street, not realizing, you know, give this guy a ball and he can just run all day.
Exactly, yeah.
Pass their way out of trouble. But yeah, like you said, yeah, water carriers isn't probably the best term to describe
yeah.
The three of them. Yeah.
I've always thought that like that term is slightly derogatory because it's kind of, it's saying like they're not the most talented, but they, Didier Deschamps to Zidane type kind of, but like they're like truly like technically brilliant players. Like if you see Frula play for Switzerland, he is like such a gifted dribbler, passer, threat from goal. Like he obviously presses like an animal, like just ground eating. They're some of the most enjoyable parts of that team is the ones who kind of screen and allow and get the ball to Gomez and Ilicic. And then now they have Kotmaners who is probably the most, I'd say he's probably the most technically gifted central midfielder that Gasperini's had at Atalanta. I think he's probably the one who's the most expressive, the most, you know, the long passer rather than just kind of the short passing. But yeah, I kind of wanted to, in each chapter, just kind of outline who the personnel were, how they changed between each year. So the development from having, let's say, Toloi, Caldara, Tomasiello, to then having Palomino in there, to having Romero, how that changed and how that then made the team look, how Gin City, like what they brought to the team and that sort of thing. But really the book started with me doing a kind of brief potted history of the club because it's not one that's particularly well told in English. There are some books in Italian about a kind of extensive chronicling of Atalanta, but I felt I wanted to include a bit of that before, because I think it's important to the point of why this is so incredible. What they've done is because of all that went on for the 110 years before it. That's the kind of the context to it. And yeah, I felt I couldn't really do the justice of almost hyping up the past 5 years without touching on that.
Not success, is it?
No, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And then, yeah, I've done a brief chapter on the ultras in there and my own kind of travel guide type introduction to it about my kind of like walking through Bergamo. And just the kind of the subtitle to the book is the tactics, culture and community behind Gasperini's Atalanta. And all three of those, the tactics, culture and community, were what I wanted to kind of tie into everything and kind of triangulate all the information into those three. So yeah, that's the kind of a synopsis, I suppose, of where it hopefully has ended up.
Perfect. Well, that sounds great. That sounds awesome. I'm really looking forward to reading it. I'll better let you go. We could talk for hours and that's just about Coop Miners, but
I honestly could. Yeah, you'll have to stop me. Thank you very much.
Oh, no worries. The Working Hand of a Goddess, the Atalanta story, as told by Tom Underhill. 18th of July, it's released via Pitch Publishing. And yeah, that's great. Thanks for coming on and thanks for talking to us today, Tom.
Thank you ever so much for having me on, Frank. Thank you.
No problems. Thanks again. That was a great chat with Tom Underhill, the author of the soon-to-be-released book on Atalanta, The Working Hand of a Goddess. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Don't forget to rate, review, and share the show where possible. Thanks, everyone, again. Take care and enjoy your calcio.